Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Alice. Alice is, I don't know who Ryder is, but a man by the name of Hollis is the international president of ASIFA, which is the animation honorary all over the world, very big in Europe.
Well, this book to me appeared as though it was really thrown together pretty quickly. In the beginning, there's a bit of an introduction, but then it just goes to pretty poorly, if I can give you an example here, cropped pictures. I mean, parts of it disturb me because what they do, to give you an example, here's a Woody Woodpecker that they just did this to. And I don't know, somewhat that kind of bothers me a little bit. But I just picked that book up pretty cheaply, and I've been able to have quite a few things in there signed. I'll be meeting with
John Hollis, that's the guy. First published in Great Britain in 1976 by Tryon Books, and that's where he is. He's in England, Hollis. He's a big shot in animation in Europe. Yeah. Film setting by Inline Graphics, London. Origination by Color Workshop, spelled C-O-L-O-U-R, Workshop, Hertford. Printed in Spain, for heaven's sake. Mateo Cromo Artis. Artes Graficas.
Yeah, I got that at Larry Edmonds' bookshop. And it was a little more complete than that. I've taken out about 10 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I had Jack Mercer signed some Popeye things for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's really quite nice. So I
yeah, see? President of the International Animated Film Association. And I belong to that. I belong to all the academies, of course.
Yeah, I've just written June Foray.
Oh, yeah. She's our local, has been our local president ever since they had a branch out here.
Yeah, I'm waiting for her.
Actually, it was very largely through her that I joined it, because she told me about it, and I came to a couple of meetings, and I joined. I don't think it did me any good. Yeah, it's a very interesting book. I haven't seen anything like it. Seems to lean pretty heavily on the American ones, though.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
and,
it does.
And the you know, that's a big field in Europe. Oh, my God, the Yugoslavs and the French, the Czechs, they're all big in animation.
Yeah.
Yugoslavs are remarkably big.
I'm going to give about 10 pages to the world scene, but I'm going to really keep my book on the American, because there's just too much. If I'm going to get into the locals,
you better watch out. You'll have 10 books.
That's right. I can't do that. Already, it's getting to be about 400 pages,
mm-hmm.
And I've got to keep it. I got to cut it down. I don't know where to start with you. You probably know best where to begin.
I don't know how your book is organized, though.
Well, I'm going to be putting you in different sections,
mm-hmm.
Because there will be a Dr. Zoo section. There is going to be a voiceover section.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Well, that was my biggest fear, really.
Is that where you really started out as an announcer?
I got into radio back in St. Louis when I was just a freshman in college. I had worked in the summer times at a newspaper, doing a different job every summer. And all of a sudden the paper was going downhill and they sold out to another paper. Well, heck, there wasn't much chance of a not dry behind the ears yet kid getting a job when there were full-scale, full-time newspaper people out of jobs in town, you know. So that went out the window right then. So it was the end of my freshman year in college, and I was looking for something to do in the summertime, and I was a radio bug when I was a kid. You know, I had a DX file. DX stood for distance. and you logged stations every place you could. Even late at night, you'd sit up and you'd try to reach out, and it was a big deal if you could get. This was when I lived in St. Louis, which is my hometown.
Are you originally from St. Louis?
That's where I was born. And if you got the West Coast, big deal. Texas, fine. But if you got Mexico or Cuba, and you could. It was amazing. You didn't have to sit and wait for the call letters, you see, to be sure what you were listening to.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I was really involved in radio, and I suddenly occurred to me, gee, maybe there was a place for me in radio. I always wanted to be a writer. I didn't have any idea of being a performer or an actor. Even though from the very beginning I had done it in school, you know, I was the kid that had to do the class prophecy in grammar school, and I did all kinds of auditorium sessions in high school. So I was always involved in things. If there was a play, I was in it.
You had a good but deep, I never, deep voice back then?
Not necessarily deep, but I was always pretty versatile. I could change my voice, you see. At one of the auditorium sessions, another guy and I burlesqued a whole bunch of very popular radio programs in those days. One of them was Amos and Andy, and the two of us played both characters, you know. But anyhow, starting that way, well, it occurred to me, well, heck, I'll try to get a job as an announcer. And knowing in the summertime that that's when all the announcers had their vacations, I applied to my favorite local radio station in St. Louis and said, you know, I'd like to be your summertime stand-in, take the other announcers' places. So they called me in for an audition, and they gave me their regular audition material. And when I finished, they said, you know, have you thought about other jobs, like maybe digging ditches or bookkeeping? So I said, well, if you don't like the way I announce, maybe you'd like to, I could do a one-man show for you and play all the parts. And they said, no kidding. And I said, sure. And they said, well, can you ad-lib something? I said, I tell you what, I'd like to write you a script. So they said, fine. So I went home and I wrote a script, and there were four regular characters, two Englishmen and two black guys. And I came back, and it was a story of an English nobleman who wanted to see the United States casually, you know, from the inside. So he gets a big Rolls Royce and hires a chauffeur and a footman, and his valet is with him. So the valet and the English nobleman, Lord Algy, were the two main characters, and then the two black guys, the chauffeur and the footman, were the ones that always got him out of trouble. And of course, they were all the people they met on the way. Each show was 15 minutes long, and it involved some kind of a mix-up they got into. So I had to play all the other characters, too. I wrote it, played all the characters, and announced it, and did any manual sound effects that were necessary, like doors closing, and they paid me $5 a show. And
which was pretty good at the time.
Well, no, that was about as low as you got, really. Yeah, $5 a show for writing it and doing it, you know, my God. And then after a couple of weeks of it, the head of the studio heard it and thought I had, you know, liked all the voices, and so he put me on the late night. They used to have an orchestra show every night. I think it was from 11 to 12 or 11 to 1, something like that. A local orchestra right there at the station, you know. The staff orchestra.
Yeah.
And each night I did it and emceed it in a different dialect and as a different character. In those days, you know, you could do any dialect and nobody said you were being anti-ethnic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the that lasted all summer. And in the fall, they sold the time spot to somebody else, and that was the end of it, both shows. But, hell, I got the $5 for the 15-minute show once a week, and the other thing, I think I was on four times a week, and I think they paid me something like $20 for the four shows. And it was a much easier show to do because I didn't have to, all I had to do was line up a whole bunch of gags and get the list of their numbers and figure out silly lead-ins, and that was that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, heck, that was, now that was a big deal, $25 a week for a kid, you know.
Yeah.
That was doing good. So, from there, I went back to school in the fall without any misgivings. And at the end of the second year, end of my sophomore year, I lost my scholarship because the guy who had been the donor lost his money. He was the same guy who had owned the newspaper that I had worked on, which is how I got the job there in the first place. Yeah. And as a result of that, I was looking now, and what was I going to do to get back into college? I couldn't afford to pay the tuition. Well, the college was very good to me. They gave me a loan of half of it, and I found a half scholarship and I had lying around, and that they gave me outright for the last 2 years. But now I had to find some work to pay back that tuition, the loan, you see. And I auditioned at a smaller radio station in town, and the same show. And they liked the idea, and they put me on there, but they put me on without paying me anything, because I'd already gotten paid for the show, see. So they did two a week, which was going to run me out of shows a lot faster. And there was a guy had a kid show on there, and he heard some of these voices, so he had me come in to do his show. It was called The Pirate Club. It was on 5 days a week, and he paid me $1 a week, which was for car fare, because it was 10 cents each way.
$1 a week.
Right at the, you know, just when it was getting toward August, and I was really getting worried because the idea was they were going to try to sell the show, seeing if they sold it, then I was going to get paid.
Yeah.
Well, just when it was getting to the point where I was wondering whether they were really trying to sell it or not, I knew some of the salesmen, and they were friendly, you know. CBS bought out KMOX, which had been always affiliated with them, but had not been owned by them. Well, they bought the station. So that meant all the personnel got fired and a whole new group came in.
I watched 2 years of KMOX. When I was going over there working for the Crofts. I did 2 years in St. Louis.
You did?
Yeah, from...
Well, anyhow, I auditioned for the new program director at KMOX, and I not only had that one-man show, but I had another show, a one-man kid show, which was a storyteller, the old storyteller. And the storyteller would spin yarns, and then the yarns would be dramatized, and I would play all the parts. And I had a little character in it called Montgomery Mouse, which I did. I can't do it anymore because I don't have the back teeth. I used to put air in my cheek and poke it and be able to talk that way. And in that way, I could talk in two voices simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Of course, they would say the same things. So they liked that. They hired me as the junior announcer because they said, we can't buy this right away, but we sure do want to use that. And the program director said, you're a handy guy to have around with all these voices, you know, and anything... We dramatize, hell, we can use you in it. There wasn't enough work in a town the size of St. Louis to pay an actor who was itinerant, you know, who just acted when they called him, a living wage, obviously. So they said, we'll pay you $25 a week, and you'll be the junior announcer, but the first 2 weeks you work for nothing and you learn the ropes. In the middle of the second week, Missouri Pacific Railroad came around for a show, and they had an idea of an old-timer character. His name was the Citizen of the Southwest, and he spun yarns about things that happened in the Southwest and, if possible, could tie in with the Missouri Pacific Railroad. And they had a Pullman Porter Quartet and a small orchestra, 6 days a week, 15 minutes. So they called in any available actors from the little theater, and they used me too and auditioned me, and I got the job as the Citizen. In fact, they kept the curtains closed so the client couldn't see what a beardless youth I was. I was supposed to be about 65 years old, you know. And I won it, and I never did start at 25. I started at 42, which was a pretty nice deal. Now, that was in 32, because 31 was when I'd worked at the other station. And right away, of course, I was at the bottom rung of the announcer staff. And I stayed there for 7 years and worked my way up as high as you could go. Assistant chief announcer. The chief announcer was their sports announcer, mm-hmm. Franz Lox, who was nationally known for his baseball. He always did the World Series for CBS. And then, as I said, I got married, and I couldn't go any further than that. That was the biggest station in town and the best job I could get. So I pulled loose and went to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And immediately got involved in all the soap operas, and I worked every place in Chicago. When I left Chicago, I was in Chicago for almost exactly 5 years, because I came in April and I left in April. When I left, I had been doing a minimum of 45 programs a week.
Wow.
Most of it was announcing, but I played a lot of roles because I announced Ma Perkins, but I played the romantic lead on The Romance of Helen Trent. I was Gil Whitney, the guy she never married, you know. And when it became obvious that radio was leaving Chicago and going to either coast, mm-hmm. My wife and I discussed it, and she came out here. She had been to New York, so she knew what it was like. And she came out here and fell in love with California. And I made the break, on my own. I didn't have a job to come to. But when I resigned all the shows I had, three of them, it turned out, I could do here. One of them I took with me. It was the Coronet Storyteller, which had started in Chicago. I did there five nights a week. Well, when I told them I was coming out here, after a lot of soul searching, they decided to let me do the show here. And they did. And I had been announcing Hildegard for Raleigh Cigarettes in Chicago, and they moved me to the Skelton Show here. Mm-hmm. And I had been doing, what the hell was the other one? Ma Perkins for Procter & Gamble, and they moved me out here to Draft Star Playhouse, which is another product, but, you know, still Procter & Gamble. So I started here with 11 shows a week, which is not bad, you know. One of the things that I did in the kid field, even in the early days, I started that in St. Louis and did it again in Chicago. Around Christmas time, I did a Santa Claus program, and I have always been a good Santa Claus. Hell, I'm built for it now. But the idea was to justify Santa Claus, you know, to bring him up to date, mm-hmm. So the kids wouldn't ask embarrassing questions. I mean, how did he manage to cover the globe in one night? Mm-hmm. And how did he really keep track of all the kids? And how did he get in the house if they didn't have a chimney? And in each case, there was another character in it who was an aviator who flies to the North Pole and discovers Santa's workshop. And he takes him on a tour of a different factory each day, the doll factory, the toy factory, the candy. It would use all the sound effects you could figure out, you know, to keep it interesting. And that was very successful. I did it 3 years in St. Louis, and I did it 2 years in Chicago, the first 2 years I was there, and they sold it to a department store. Mm-hmm. In St. Louis, I think we had the same sponsor, a dairy each year, Peabody Dairy. But anyhow, that was a kid program, which I started in very early in the business. And then when I got to Chicago and was working as an actor in so many shows, oh heck, I was on just about all of them. I was on one of the first jobs I got when I came to Chicago was on Little Orphan Annie. And then I worked on Jack Armstrong and Captain Midnight, and I can't even remember all of them now. Not all the time, you know, but I'd get running roles on it and keep them for a year or so. So I've always been involved in kid entertainment, but the only one that I can think of, the only ones that I can think of that were my own, you know, that I originated, were the one that got me the job at KMOX, the treasure chest, it was called, and the one, the Santa Claus thing.
What did you do in the treasure chest now? What kind of
that was? He was an old storyteller, you know, very hardy type. Well, Monty, what's the good word today? You know.
Almost like a pirate. How
well, he wasn't a pirate. No, he was a happy guy, happy-go-lucky guy, you know. But a deep voice like that, you know, Uncle Joe. And it wasn't as broad as the Santa Claus character. Because the Santa Claus character, you know, was very hardy. Whoa! Always, oh, you know.
Yeah, your lips do a good Santa right there. Yeah.
But, and I've done it on some TV commercials too, by the way. So, that was the extent of kid entertainment in radio, I think. Because when I got out here, there just weren't that many kid programs anymore on radio.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that was?
Well, radio was beginning to fade anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any kid programs that were originated out here after I got out here. There undoubtedly were some, but I don't remember what they were. But of course, as television started, one of the very first television programs that I got on and was on many times, as I mentioned in my letter, was Space Patrol.
Space Patrol, mm-hmm. And Captain Zero.
Well, that was only on one of those.
Tell me about Space Patrol.
Space Patrol was wonderful. When they started the show, there were four running characters.
I know
two girls and two guys.
Very little about that. I have
Well, it was on ABC, and it was done at their studio on Prospect and Talmadge, where they're still located, and it was a lot more primitive in those days because it was a converted movie studio, you know, used to be Vitagraph. And when it was a 15-minute show every day, they had so many effects. You know, you saw spacecraft lifting off, and, well, you had to do that in miniature. This was live.
Yeah.
This was not film. And they hadn't invented tape yet. Videotape. So they had very little time to actually rehearse the actors.
Yeah, yeah.
The biggest deal was to do a camera rehearsal so they knew where their positions were, but who the heck had time to learn the lines? They practically ad-libbed the show. It really was remarkable. And it was so successful, it was on the network, but it wasn't... they didn't have a cable in those days. They kinnied it and sent it to other towns. But it was so successful that they had a regular network version of it on Saturday. And that was a half-hour show, and it was kinnied too. It was live. And then that was the one I really started working on. I didn't work on the daily one because the daily one practically never used anybody but the four characters. But on the weekend one, they had all kinds of incidental characters that came in. And apparently what I had done on the show was so successful that they wrote a character in called Mr. Proteus. Well, you know who Proteus was, the god who could change his shape into any other shape. And the term is used for actors. They talk about protean people, you know,
so
means that an actor can
change.
Well, Mr. Proteus could become anybody he wanted.
Uh-huh.
And in six consecutive weeks, I played a different role each week,
mm-hmm.
always revealing myself at the end as yes. Mr. Proteus, you see. Well, Mr. Proteus was me straight. The others were all wild characters, you know. Some of them were really far out. And it was very successful because it had to be broad enough and different enough so the kids would not figure that Commander Corey was a jerk not to know it was me again, because Mr. Proteus was a villain. There wasn't any question about that. So the kid would catch it before the hero would, you know. I mean, the kid viewer. Mm-hmm. But it couldn't be so obvious or phony a character that they would say, he's an idiot not to know that that's Mr. Brody. So it really was a challenge, a big challenge for the makeup department, too, because they had to do a hell of a job. But that was...
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And the characters I did, one of them that I was my great pet, they mussed up my hair and sprayed... Oh, and another thing that was tricky on that was that since it was live action, I had to be able to get out of the makeup before the end of the show and reveal myself as Mr. Proteus on live camera, you see. So you didn't go into the makeup room and sit there for half an hour because the show was running. You had to do it in 1 minute. Yeah. You know?
Do you have any pictures of this?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Matter of fact, I think I've got one I can give you if you want it.
Well, I can get copies in return.
No, but I think I've got a lot of them. I think enough of them, and where else am I ever going to use them, you know? And it has, I think, four or five of the characters. The sixth character was a doctor, and he had a mask on, so it really was not that much of a challenge, you know?
Is it something you have to dig for? Or?
No, I can get them out of my office and nothing flat. If you want to wait a few seconds,
sure,
I'll bring it out.
As long as we're on it now.
Sure. This is probably the best of the late pictures. But here are the six characters. The one in the lower left, or lower right rather, is me as Mr. Proteus, you know, the straight role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the others were the...
Now that's great. I can have this one?
Sure.
That's great. I like to use this.
Welcome to it.
That's a lot of fun.
My favorite was the one in the middle at the top.
This one's fun.
Oh, he was a silly ass Englishman, you know. But the...
This one here.
Yeah. He was an old New England skipper type, you know, one of those fellas. Sounded like Titus Moody. The old Fred Allen show. I played a role like that in One Man's Family for about 6 years in radio.
I reckon this looks similar to Fidel Castro here.
Oh no, he was a real tough Western type that talked out of the corner of his mouth and had a big limp. Name was Gimpy.
He looks like
and
he
that was a sort of a Cliff Arquette character, you know, one of those little fellas.
And I've always been famous for my Chinese roles, so that's no surprise to see me as the Mandarin down there in the middle.
You have one of those faces that you know that person from somewhere, but you can't put your finger on it, you know? You can't put your finger on it.
Probably the reason I'm not a star. And I've always been, you know, a little too versatile because there's never one role that they saw.
Yeah.
The Millionaire was the role that people remember me for the most, of course, you know, because that one they saw me every week and it was an extremely popular program and it practically killed my career in pictures.
Yeah.
That and my inability to get a good agent, because the thing to do the minute the series was over was for an agent to go out and sell me on something else.
Mm-hmm.
that was as far away from that as it possibly could be, because, see, up to that time in pictures, I had done nothing but heavies, which was fine. And I had a whole Chinese cycle, because I did Chinese rolls in half a dozen pictures, four pictures, I think. And they were, you know, quite successful. Now, of course, you can't play a Chinese unless you're an Oriental.
And you have, no, I question that because you have all this Oriental.
Oh, yes. Well, we've always been nuts about Chinese things. And my wife spent many years in Hong Kong in various business enterprises that she had. But actually, most of this furniture we bought even before she went over there. Like that. This one she brought back from there. This was actually a bed. What they call an opium couch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it had a fence around three sides of it, a big one in the back and two at the ends. But we plugged all those holes where the fences, they just pulled out, you know. And they put big cushions on them, you know, and you lay on the cushions and smoked an opium pipe.
Yeah. And the rain lets you don't fall out of bed, yeah? Do you think the millionaire has been your best achievement?
It's not best because it wasn't that great a show. Actually, you know, it wasn't a terrible, well, it was in a way.
But that's what
it wasn't
what
a tremendous challenge because I didn't have that much to do in each show.
Yeah.
But as the show went on, I made enough of the character out of nothing.
Uh-huh.
To make it get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the last year that it was done, I had several shows in which I appeared all through the show.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of them I got arrested for murder. Another one I almost killed. And I had to get out of it myself, you know. And that was because people were identifying more with Michael Anthony, which was the character that I played. But when it started out, hell, I just got the check from my boss, whom you never saw, you only heard him, you know.
Yeah.
And then I went and found a person and gave him the check. So my part of the show, I knocked mine off in a day, less than a day. But the show usually shot for 3 days. In those days, you could shoot a half hour show in 3 days. And it was in black and white, so you didn't have the problem in lighting you do in color.
Then what would be your favorite thing that you've ever done?
Well, you know, if you mean all fields, I suppose it was the recording of the Bible.
Oh, really?
Because that was really a challenge. I did the whole thing, you know, both New and Old Testaments. And to this day, they've never released all of the Old. They've got the records.
Uh-huh.
They've got the tapes, but they've never released it. That took 2.5 years.
And it probably had never been done before.
Well, at the time I did it, I don't think it had ever been done before. And I don't know still whether it was ever done by one person.
Mm-hmm.
I know Alexander Scorby did a version for the blind. I think that's the Library of Congress recordings.
Mm-hmm.
But whether he did all of the Old Testament or not, I am not sure. Orson Welles did a big section of it, I know, of the New Testament, but I don't think he did all of it. But it took, as I said, 2.5 years to record it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I approached it with the idea that each book of the Bible was a book all by itself. And I researched it and I did comparisons with other recording, with other translations of the Bible. And I read a half a dozen. And I'd come up with 7 pronunciations. And then I had to figure out which one to use.
I did the voice for Jesus Christ in the crucifixion scene at Movie Land Wax Museum.
No kidding.
And I knew what you mean.
Because, uh-huh.
One time when I was doing Charlie Chaplin at the time there, I was a kid. And and the creator of the wax figures, Logan Fleming, said to me, "What do you think of this tape?" And he played it. And I heard this kid saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And he said, "Well, what do you think of it?" You know, and I said, "Well, who's it supposed to be?" And he says, that's Jesus talking when he's on the cross, in the crucifixion scene. And I laughed, you know. I said, who is this guy? Where'd you find him? This is my son.
Oh, gosh.
And so I said, you can just pay some person who does this professionally to get this done. I mean, this is a nice, you know, the Moomin Wax Museum.
Sure,
I mean,
yeah. I've never been there, but I know what
it's like.
It's
a big place.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm.
Hi.
I'm home.
Mr. Mayor, Mrs. Miller, Elizabeth,
hi.
Paul.
Hi. Nice to meet you. Any messages?
Not a thing.
Okay.
You know, so I said, well, I can do a better job than that. He says, we'll give it a try. We don't have the budget to pay anyone. So I went home and I spent the day doing it 15 different ways. And it's still there. They're still using
no
it.
No kidding.
And that's been after 10 years almost. Yeah.
I did the track for much of the stuff at Knott's in Independence Hall.
Oh, really?
I think they still have it. They have a slide film show first, you know. I narrated that. Then you go over. And when you're standing in the actual room in which the discussion on the declaration was made and finally passed, they have speakers at each of the desks with people who were supposed to be sitting
uh-huh.
there talking.
Uh-huh.
And I did John Hancock, and I think it was John Adams. Or it was one of the Adams, either John or Sam. And the voice comes out of the desk. You see, you're supposed to be hearing mm-hmm. ghosts talking, you know? That was quite a...
I haven't been in there yet.
Oh, it's been there for years.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. The hall is beautiful because it is an absolute to-the-inch replica.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every brick in it is exactly like the bricks in the original.
It's amazing. Yeah, I recorded some things for their Knott's Berry Farm, Calico Street area.
Oh, yeah.
And I recorded announcements for the Chicken Dinner Restaurant and the stunt shows.
Mm-hmm. I still go down there and do jobs for him every so often. Tommy Walker is programming a lot of their special entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember him. He used to be Disney's outdoor specialist when he had the big jazz parades up and down Disneyland streets. He would stage them.
Mm-hmm.
And he always does the big 4th of July show mm-hmm. at the Anaheim Stadium. And he was in charge of all the outdoor spectacular stuff at the Spokane World's Fair.
Wow.
So whenever he does anything at all, and he can use an MC or a voice guy or whatever, he calls me.
Yeah.
The last thing I did down there was MC the opening of the Roaring Twenties section
mm-hmm.
at Knott's. But then I also did a Halloween.
I closed Gypsy Camp, which was in the same place. Yeah, I was the last person to perform there.
Well, I also did their Halloween show, did a couple of the tracks, you know, where
uh-huh.
they had pantomime behind a sheet, so they just used a voice track. Well, I
this
did a couple
really
of characters.
This is really wild, you know, because it was just after I closed that show that they wanted me to do a Halloween show for them. They asked me to come up with a whole, and what they wanted me to do was pantomime behind a sheet, a doctor doing an operation.
I did that track. I did the track on it.
Well, I didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
They wanted me to do it. And they said they'd pay me to do this mime
mm-hmm.
bit behind the sheets, because they knew I could do that kind of stuff.
I don't know who they got to do it, but I never even saw it.
Yeah.
They had about, you know, 8 or 9 different shows at different places.
Yeah, different places, And I had a 47 Cadillac limousine at the time, and I created a show called the Vampire Dance Show. And what it was you know, all the monsters come out of this Cadillac
uh-huh.
limousine that pulls up, and they do, it was a dance routine. It was funny
mm-hmm.
because here they were dancing pretty fast. Frankenstein, werewolf.
Mm-hmm.
And Dracula, they were doing the threesome kind of, you know, and it was funny to see them all of a sudden go into this step. And I recorded the whole show on videotape
mm-hmm.
and brought it to them. And they didn't want to pay enough.
who did you get to do the other characters in it?
Oh, the other characters?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have a lot of friends that have done puppet shows with me, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have a lot of friends of mine that are with the Will Gear's group.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that was a blow when he passed on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He looked so healthy every time I saw him on a show.
Or Carson all the time.
Yeah, he was just great, you know.
Yeah.
So it must have been kind of sudden, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, he had been sick for 2 months.
Yeah, but I mean that time.
And I think he had been fine. Yeah, he's always said he was doing fine. But he didn't want his friends, and especially his students or anyone, to know
what did he actually die of, do you know?
I don't know.
What was the illness? Was it cancer?
Well, I think he had some heart ailment, but he was in the hospital for 2 months before. He kept it private. Only his family knew about it. So it was kind of a shock.
I think it's always a bad idea to go to a hospital. More people die there than
they It's like the movie The Hospital. You see that movie The Hospital?
Oh, yeah. Of course, that was a phony device, because it turns out, you know, near the end, that it's one guy who's off his nut that's causing all the trouble.
Yeah.
But at the beginning of the film, you begin to say, now this is telling it like it is, you know. They've got this coming. Because there's so much mismanagement and silly things that happen in hospitals that no excuse for.
Yeah, you can actually get sick of
hospitals. Yep. I haven't been in them too often, but I've been in them often enough to say, screw them. 3 times, I think.
Let me jump let me see. Where should I go to? Ozzie and Harriet? Should we go to that?
Well, I used to, see, in radio I did so many shows that I was almost a regular on. Mm-hmm. And it's a funny thing.
I just got a letter back from her, by the way.
She's a wonderful
lady. Yeah, she's moving right now, but she asked me to hold on.
Well, if you get to see her, you will enjoy talking to her, because she's still a very attractive gal, although she's gotten along in years now, of course, but she's a wonderful dame. I just loved her. See, when I came out here, I was the announcer on this. I was moved, you know, from Hildegard in Chicago to the Red Skelton Show.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he led the orchestra on the Skelton Show, and she was the vocalist. And she played the mother of the mean widow kid that was one of Red's famous characters, you know. And I started playing characters on that show. That's why they gave me the job, because they needed somebody who was versatile enough to, if they wrote a new little character in, I could double it, you know. And when I first came out, he treated me like a dog, and after about 3 or 4 weeks, we were in the Derby, Elizabeth and I, one night, and he came in and sat across from us, and then he came over and sat next to us and said, I want to apologize for being such a bastard so far as you're concerned. I thought you were a spy from the head of the agency in Chicago that he put on the show to watch for me, you know.
Yeah.
But we got along fine, and I kept doing his show until he went into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ended his show. And immediately, Ozzie and Harriet went off on their own and started this Situation Family show. And they asked me to announce it. Well, I was tickled pink. MCA was my agent at that time, and the guy who was handling me said, oh, you don't want to do that. It's another one of these damn situation comedies. It's not going any place. And I said, oh, I'd like to work. No, forget it. They won't pay enough anyhow. I begged them. No way. Wouldn't let me. So they got Vern Smith, and he announced the show for many years in radio, but they still remembered me. So after a while, they started calling me in to play characters on it. Well, I wasn't one of the regular characters, but I played a different one. You know, whenever something came up, they'd call me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was almost a regular on that show in radio. And then when they went into television, I did, I think, 3. I know 2 for sure. One of them, I played Michael Anthony. It was a dream sequence, you know. He thinks he gets a check, The other one, which was one of my favorites, was I was the cheer-up guy from his lodge when he's sick at home. And I come in to cheer him up and wind up eating all the fruit in his fruit bowl. And depressing him so he's really ready to die, you know. It's a funny sequence, very funny. But I didn't work with him as often. Well, you know, that's a problem in television. You can't work on the show all the time because people will say, hey, what the heck is this? The same person coming back playing a different part?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very difficult to repeat on the same show.
Yeah, that's what you get for being a character actor, I guess.
Well, you could, same thing would be true with the straight, you know, with the lead. When One Man's Family went on television, and it was on television out here on a 15-minute basis daily, I had already been on the radio show for a long time. And in 1 year, it later moved to New York and became a half-hour, once-a-week show. Oh, I didn't have anything to do with that. But when it was on here as a half-hour show, I played 6 different characters in that 1 year. Now, of course, they were just one-shots, you know. But that was pretty good.
Yeah.
But that was because Carlton Morris liked me, you know, and knew I was versatile and put on a mustache or a different kind of makeup.
Have you stayed in
back? As a matter of fact, I got a running role, the father of the guy who married the gal who was one of the twins. And there was going to be a big conflict between me and Father Barber in the story. And I just got the role, and The Millionaire started.
Yeah.
So I had to give it up. So that I did for that 1 year very happily, you know. What did you start to ask me? Sorry.
About Red Skelton.
Yeah.
Have you stayed in touch with him at all? I mean,
No. After he came back. After
I
mean, he came back from the Army. By the time he came back from the Army, I was doing the Old Gold Show. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I couldn't go back on for Raleigh's, you know.
Yeah.
So they got Rod, what the hell was his name? He was their announcer for quite a few years. Then he left town and went to Salt Lake to become program director of a station there, and Art Gilmore took it over. Well, Art Gilmore was his announcer for as long as he had a TV show on. Oh, no, he was very loyal to the people he had, you know. Once you started with him, you stayed. Mm-hmm. So I was sorry about that. But, of course, as the Old Gold announcer, I was the announcer for Sinatra.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did his show for 2 years. Hmm. Then when he went off, they put another show on that had Don Ameche and Francis Langford playing a character couple called the Bickersons. Mm-hmm. And the other show was Frank Morgan. And I was his stooge. I was the announcer, so I was his stooge, too. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything on the Bickerson, but just announce him. They had 15 minutes, and Morgan had 15 minutes. It was called the Old Gold Show, and that ran a year. Then I did another show for Old Gold, and after that, they stopped sponsoring shows that came from here. Mm-hmm. So I never could go back and do some other cigarette, you know, because I'd already been stuck with Old Gold.
I sent a letter out to Danny Thomas, and I got a letter right back from him right away.
Oh?
And he's doing some fairs or something right now, he'll be back in town in 3 weeks, and he wants to meet with me then.
Fine. He's a pretty nice guy. He believes that he's the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. And
another one of those?
And that he is a great, he makes a personal crusade out of this home in Memphis for kids, you know, hospital. Mm-hmm. But he does a hell of a job with it. Let's face it, you know, I mean, the very fact that he is their chief sponsor and his pictures are on their stamps for Christmas and all that. Well, so what? He raises a heck of a lot of money. He runs telethons for him, you know. So he really does do a lot of good work for causes. There's no question about it. But I found him about fine to work with. I did one show on his series, and I played a Chinese father. And the story was about a little Chinese girl who plays very good piano. And the gal was Ginny Chu. I guess she's still around. She must be grown up by now. But she was cute, and she spoke practically no English. She was one of a bunch of kids. Her father was, you know, a typical exploiter of his kids, like a lot of the Chinese are apt to be if they've got something there to sell. And she was learning classical piano, but the minute the father was away, she'd start playing boogie. And that was the whole deal, you know. And of course, at the end of the show, he gets me to agree that she really should be able to play anything she wants. Sure, she'll play classical, but she should have fun too. And typical, you know.
But you announced that same show as well.
I announced it earlier. I may have been announcing it at that time, but of course, in television, when you announce a show, you don't always, even though it was shot with an audience like his show was, you don't always appear at the beginning of the show. Maybe if it's an audience participation show, yes, then you do. Or you may be off camera, but you know, you're there. But when I was doing his show, I did all of my openings and closings and lead into the product commercials and all that stuff at one day at Glen for about 10 shows. Knocked them off just like that.
Yeah,
so I didn't even see the shows. But that I guess was about the last, no, it wasn't the last Chinese role I did, because I did some Charlie Chan commercials after that. But it was the last full-size role in any medium in which I played a Chinese. It was a good part. It was a funny part because, you know, he got very angry with the little daughter. He'd catch her playing boogie and raise hell.
Now, you did a lot of stuff for Disney now, too.
The things I did for Disney were narration. It's a funny thing. With all of the experience I had in doing many voices, like for Filmation, I did in Fantastic Voyage, there were six lead characters, five men and a girl. Three of the guys and the girl were on the boat. The other two were back at headquarters. The leader was the guy you never saw. You just saw his profile, and he had a very deep and authoritative voice. The other one was a scientist, and Ted Knight did that. Then the three guys on the boat, there was Jeff something or other, and he was the real heroic lead type, and that was played by Ted. And the other two were the pilot, who was an eager, bigger, beaver kind of kid, you know, one of those. And I played that, and then the guru, who was a Hindu who could hypnotize anybody. This came in very well with some of the villains they met, you know, when they were just about ready to be exterminated. He would throw up an illusion through mass hypnosis. And in those days, I could do a Hindu accent better than I remember. Now I'd have to sharpen up on it. But he had a very, you know, the Hindu accent is very clipped. And they have a funny way of talking. Almost sounds like a cross between Welsh and German. Very funny inflection.
Das Butler does it by sticking his tongue up here. He found if he put his tongue.
Oh, really?
Up there. He could do it. The only way he could do it. But he did it for me, too, and he did a really good one.
Well, there was a kid show on television, and you didn't have it in your list, so I forget, didn't enter it, called Maya.
Yeah.
It was shot in India, and it ran for just 1 year. It was a Saturday afternoon or early evening show, hour long, about two kids, a Hindu kid and an American kid. and an elephant. And Maya was the elephant. And I don't remember how the American kid got to be a runaway.
I think I might remember that.
Oh, it was quite a show. It had a lot of production in it, you know. The kid who played the young kid was the kid who played Jay North.
Oh, really?
Dennis the Menace.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, heck, you know, okay, he had added a... He was a teenager when he played that.
Come back to me now.
And the kid who played the Hindu was a real, honest-to-God Hindu actor named Rajat Singh, who got to be a real idol of the teeners. Because he's a very handsome kid. And he got to be a brave. The thing was shot in India. It was done in English, of course. But the soundtrack was unbelievable. It was done by the King Brothers, and who were always kind of schlocky producers anyhow. You may remember they did a lot of, you know, B or C pictures. Don't remember the King Brothers? Oh, yeah. And everything had to be looped.
Really?
Everything. Well, they found a kid over... See, the cast was stuck over there. They were there. Well, they found a kid, and I don't know his name, and I don't know whatever happened to him, whatever became him. He was quite young. I think he was younger than Jay was at the time. Mm-hmm. But he could imitate Jay's voice perfectly, and he could also do the Rajat Singh's voice. So he looped both of their voices, and you couldn't tell that it was, you know, somebody else. But they just couldn't use the track. It had all kinds of noises, background noises, you know, planes flew over, trucks coming down the road. They didn't do anything to retake it, you know. Mm-hmm. And some of the Hindu actors that they used, such thick accents, they were almost unintelligible. Mm-hmm. And June Foray played all the women and kids, little kids, and I did everybody else. Now, once in a while, they had an actor from here whom they actually sent over to do a part in it, and then he could do his own voiceover when he got back.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were only about four or five of those out of the whole series, and mm-hmm. I think there were something like 18 or 20 of them. And I did all the other characters.
That's interesting.
I'd have a scene in which there were four guys talking, you know. It was very lucky that at that time, the present way of looping, which isn't really looping at all anymore, was developed, what they now call ADR, you know, mm-hmm. additional dialogue recording. You used to have actual loops of film, of a sentence or a paragraph or whatever. They'd cut the film up and splice it together. Mm-hmm. And that loop would run and run and run, and you started to sync to it, and when you finally got it, that was fine. And they took the loop off and put another loop up. That's where the term came, looping. But now they'll start a reel, and they'll have the original track on it, you see, and you hear that in the earphones. And there's also, when your cue comes up for you to start talking, there's a thing on the track, three beats. Beep, 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 and you take it on the fourth. That's when you say your first sound.
That must really be hard to do.
It's tricky, but once you get the knack of it, it gets, you can do it pretty well. Some things have to be done over and over and over again to make them fit, but that's usually, if it isn't the same language that you're doing, mm-hmm. Then it's the writing that may be at fault. You have to think of other ways to say it that'll fit.
Yeah.
But in the case of the show Maya, for instance, you said the same thing the actors were saying. So it really wasn't as tough. You're looping a foreign picture and doing English to make it fit their lips. That's a lot tougher.
Yeah, yeah.
But this, you see, was the actual word itself. But so they have it. They have something like four. Nowadays, I think it's three tracks, one, two, three. But in those days, I think they had as many as four, maybe even five, different tracks running. So you could record a character, and it was usually, and it still is, usually done this way. You'd play the character throughout the reel. Then they roll back to the beginning of the reel and you do another character.
Yeah, yeah.
And they put that on another channel.
That's how I do my tapes for my shows.
Yeah. You do it on several channels?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, they do that on another channel. So with these four or five guys in this one sequence that I had, they were interrupting each other, yeah, talking on top of each other. Well, you could do it with the channels,
yeah,
you see.
Yeah, yeah.
And another great thing about it is at any time, you can play it back, any and all of the channels,
yeah,
and see if they're not too close.
Take something
you know,
out, maybe, and...
No, I mean, see how it sounds.
Yeah.
Be sure you're not getting too close to the way you played another character.
Yeah.
Well, I hold the record at Glenn Glanner, I did for many years, for the greatest number of loops done in one day, and it was something like 300.
Wow.
There were only two or three, I think, maybe not even that many, maybe it was just two, that took us more than one day to do. And when you stop and figure, you know, an hour show is a fairly long thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure that I'm doing all the characters, not just one. Hey, that ain't bad. But that was a ball. Show was opposite, I think, the Jackie Gleason show. And unfortunately for it, the Gleason show was so popular, even with kids,
mm-hmm,
that it didn't catch on the way it should have. It didn't get the rating NBC. It was on NBC, and they expected a much higher rating. But it there were some things in it that were done a little schlockily, you know, because, as I say, the producers of the King Brothers were notorious edge cutters. That's why they filmed the thing in India in the first place,
yeah,
you know, because
yeah,
they figured it was
yeah,
going to be much cheaper.
Sure.
And India has a tremendous movie industry, you know. They probably make more pictures a year than any country in the world,
yeah,
more than we do.
Yeah, they're good fans over there.
Oh, they haven't got anything else to do
yeah,
but go to the movies,
yeah,
you poor people. But all of them are terrible pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But they figured, you know, with that big an industry, heck, they could get their crews, their lighting people and all
sure,
that, pick
sure,
them up there and
sure,
get them much cheaper.
Sure.
And a lot, and 90% of the actors,
yeah,
too. And this was true, they did. They had a couple of actors in it who were great. It was one comic that did a couple of the shows, different characters, you know. But he was so funny.
Hmm.
He had marvelous takes and reactions. And, he had a wild dialect, which I tried to get as close to as I could.
Tell me about Gerald now.
Gerald McBoing Boy?
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't remember how I got in at UPA. I don't even know how I did my first thing there. I don't think I was sold by an agent, and I don't think I ever, you know, called them up and asked them.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow I got called on to do something over there, and from then on I started doing just about everything that was done at UPA.
Yeah, now if
there was a producer there named Robert Cannon. They always called him Bo.
Mm-hmm.
And his films were very funny and very adventuresome. You know, they did things that Disney never thought of doing.
Mm-hmm.
UPA got started that way by being daring, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did a retrospective of his films about 10 years ago at the Screen Directors Theater, and I went to see it, and I was amazed because over half of them I had done.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way I got in at UPA. So along comes this idea to do Gerald McBoing Boing. I don't remember who the producer was, but I know that Teehee had a lot to do with it. And Teehee is still very active. You know him at all?
No.
That's really his name, Teehee.
Hmm.
And he has a line of Christmas cards. They're under that name, Teehee, and they're delightful cards. They're always very round, rosy Santa Clauses, but real cartoony, you know, very rudimentary, primitive type of things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, he had something to do with it because he was present when we recorded it. And the original Gerald McBoing, they called me, you know, and said, we'd like you to consider this. And I said, sure. And they said, now what we want you to do you're the narrator, but you also are all the characters in it. And we don't want you to have to go too far afield to make the characters sound like completely different actors, but it would be good if you could, mm-hmm. in some cases. Well, I was a school teacher and who was a woman, so obviously I wasn't going to come out sounding really female, you know. But anyhow, I came in for this thing, and they did it at night at a studio in Hollywood, which no longer exists. And they had already recorded the score and cut it to fit the picture. So what I had to do was record my lines to fit the score. Hmm. If it fit the score, it would fit the picture. So I had my script laid out between the lines of the score. Right. And the conductor stood in the control room and conducted me. And it was a wild score. What the hell was the composer's name? He's since become pretty well known, strictly in classical circles, because he's an avant-garde modern classical composer. Funny name, started with a K and it was very short. Close. Anyhow, it was a big challenge. Well, of course, the thing won the first Academy Award for UPA that they ever had. Magoo had already been established. He was their number one deal. They never won an Academy Award for Magoo, though, at this point they had, and I think they did later. But that was such a big deal that from then on they started making at least one a year, and I did them. And I think there were five or six altogether.
And what was the character like? I mean,
Gerald McBoinboy? Yeah, well, he couldn't talk, he only made sound effects. So whenever he would try to say something, a sound would come out. Mm-hmm. And he would open his mouth, you know, and it would be a blowout. A tire exploding. And of course, the original story was that his parents were so distressed because he couldn't talk and they took him to school, special schools, and he did funny things that so upset his teachers with his sound effects, you know, that they despaired of ever doing, and it turned out, and finally, that he became the whole sound effects department for a network. He did the sound effects for all the radio shows, door slams, gunshots, anything, you know. And that was the end of the original show. And the others were wild. I know one was set on Mars, I think. Either set on Mars or the Martians came down here.
A daydreamer kind of little kid that goes into all these little...
No, they weren't fantasies. They were real. But the whole thing was wild fantasy. You know, the plot line, I mean. But the only character I didn't do on them was Gerald, who never talked.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.